Thank you very much for that most gracious introduction. I can assure you that every word that I recognized seemed entirely accurate to me. Particularly also appreciate your reference just now to this phrase, conventional wisdom, which, as I'm sure you know, is my father's coinage in the second chapter of The Affluent Society, which was published in 1958. Anyway, as you say, for this lecture, I was invited by my host to blend two topics on which I've worked separately. One is the evolution of economic inequality, a research interest that I've been pursuing in conjunction with my students for over two decades now. And the other is the financial politics of Europe, and particularly as it affected Greece in the last few years, which has been an intense preoccupation, especially recently. I'm not sure I can do justice to either one in the short space of a single talk. I've produced actually two separate books this year, one on each of these themes. I look forward to their translation into Icelandic. But nevertheless, there are connections, and it may prove rewarding to explore them. The post-war economics of growth and distribution, with its remarkable proclivity for getting things wrong, chose to treat the functional distribution of income, the division between wages and profits, as an artifact of the production function. Under a presumption of steady state economic growth, constant returns to scale, and what was called neutral technological change. Thus, this functional distribution was presumed to be stable, and the personal distribution of income was largely undiscussed outside of the work of Simon Kuznets and his followers in development economics. In graduate school, I was told that working on distribution was like watching the grass grow. People were well advised to take on more interesting topics. This became untenable already 30 years ago when it became clear that in the United States, at least, the distribution of income was changing and changing quite rapidly. But when that happened, the predominant reaction in mainstream economics was to require a degree of consistency and continuity with the previous lines of thought. This led to the invocation of a concept that came to be called skill-biased technological change, the race between education and technology, as it has also been christened, which served to wrap the phenomenon of growing inequality in the comforting mantra of efficient markets. That is to say, to treat it as the consequence of impersonal technological phenomena affecting labor markets constructed as micro phenomena working through the forces of supply and demand and affected only by the intervention on the part of affected parties, workers themselves, to supply themselves with the skills which new technologies were said to be demanding. That was the state of the literature when I started wading into it already now 20 years ago. And these ideas had been developed in a near vacuum of reliable fact. Available measures of inequality were exceptionally sparse. They were conceptually heterogeneous, that is to say, sometimes dealing with consumption, sometimes with income, sometimes with household income, sometimes with personal income, sometimes with income, gross of tax, sometimes net of tax. And in other ways, they were problematic. So that even when comparative data sets began to become available in the middle 1990s, researchers were forced to substitute recondite econometrics for actual information, or else to reach, as Thomas Piketty and his associates have done, for additional records, in particular for tax records, income tax records that reveal something about what's happened to the incomes of the topmost income household income recipients in countries, for those countries that happen to have them. This is not a bad approach, but it is limited because the numbers of countries with reliable income tax records amounts to something on the order of 30, which is far less than is available in even the very sporadic coverage of the historical survey records. So that to say anything fresh and to make a significant contribution to this research required from the outset the capacity to develop new sources of information, information that could be accumulated over time in a reasonably consistent and reliable way. And my contribution, which was largely, as I say, implemented by cohorts of my PhD, occasionally master's students, was to develop a different way of measuring inequality actually in the structures of pay and of using that to estimate inequality in income, specifically household incomes, and to show that this method, which was based on administrative records that are widely available and essentially obtainable for free, can yield dense, consistent, and so far as we can assess that, and we've been doing that very energetically in recent years, accurate measures of economic inequality for comparative and historical purposes. And I want to show you just a little bit of this information. I won't belabor it. Give you a feel for the kind of work that we've been doing. This is the underlying mathematics, and the expression in the box is the sum total of what is required to make these estimates. For group data, you need a population weight of the group, and you need to know its income relative to the average of the population. If you have 30 or so provinces or industries or any other decomposition that's readily available in tabular form, with those two pieces of information, income and population, for each group, you can compute what's called the between groups component of the tile statistic. And we use that as our estimate of the state of inequality at any given time in a particular place. I won't go into further details except to say that one then can use a very simple statistical model to convert this into a measure of economic inequality. And this, for example, is a measure across counties, using 3,150 counties in the United States as the underlying units, using tax records of income inequality in the United States from 1969 up to 2009. And it corresponds very closely to what the census records would also show, with peaks in 2000 at the peak of the information technology boom, 2007 at the peak of the period just before the financial crisis, the sawtooth pattern after 2000. So it is something which essentially replicates what is available for data-rich countries, but with a very simple, inexpensive method that can be applied much more widely. And what we've done was to essentially extend this method over most of the surface of the world, and to convert it into a set of metrics of income inequality using the very standard and familiar Gini coefficient in a household format. This map gives you cool blues for the low income inequality countries and oranges and reds for the high income inequality countries. This is the 1960s using decadal averages. And you can see, of course, a distinct profile from the rich countries to the poorer countries. That profile continues to exist as you move into the 1970s and into the 1980s. You can see, if you look carefully, that I do have data for Iceland on this. It is, of course, a pale blue, so hard to distinguish from the background, but it's there. And into the 1990s and into the 2000s, what you can see is an overall tendency for inequality to rise around the world. And if you break this out in finer detail, you can see that the pattern of these increases coincides very closely with large-scale global economic phenomena, such as the debt crisis that hit Latin America in the 1980s, much of Africa, the collapse of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union at the beginning of the 1990s, the Asian crisis in the middle of late 1990s. And we have this data. It's available now in fine detail from 1963 up through about 2011, and we're continuing to bring it up to date. What are the implications of work along these lines? I think the emergent implication is that patterns in the evolution of inequality plainly exist transnationally at the continental and global scales, and they are closely reflective of major forces affecting the world economy as a whole. Forces such as interest rates, such as oil prices, depending on whether you are a producer or a consumer, and especially changes in the global financial and policy regimes, such as the end of the Bretton Woods system in 1971, the onset, as I said, of the global debt crises in 1980, collapse of communism, 1989 to 91, and the peak of the stock bubble and information technology boom in 2000. After which, by the way, there is a tendency across the world for the rise of inequality to stabilize to a certain degree. And if you take these facts together, it's a very simple inference that one can draw, that they necessarily transpose the study of inequality from this domain that I mentioned earlier of local labor market microeconomics, technology, education, also patterns of trade, to that of global monetary macroeconomics. A very interesting and, I would argue, substantial shift of focus, but one which is made essentially unavoidable if one takes seriously these patterns of contiguity in space and time. And one which poses a challenge to the economics profession insofar as if you follow the classifications codes of the Journal of Economic Literature, there is no code for work on the macroeconomics of inequality. It is still considered by definition to be a microeconomic topic, which means it's difficult to get a journal article reviewed in a proper way. It's not my conclusion alone, although I would argue that I came to it about a decade before Thomas Piketty picked it up. He has drawn a similar conclusion that these trends are on a macro phenomenon that operate on a macro scale, with a difference that in our work and evidence, there is no necessary tendency for inequality to rise. Policies and institutions matter, and indeed we do see a period of stabilization in the retreat from neoliberal ideology in Latin America, Russia, also in China, following 2000. A reprieve which is perhaps now ending because we also find a very close association between inequality and exchange rates. And as the currency values in a great many developing countries of the world have been falling in recent years, it's almost sure, if our measures are right, and associations hold, that inequality, which has been stable in Latin America, for example, for 15 years or falling, will start to rise again or already has. You can see, for example, in this decomposition in which we show the contributions of six major sectors to inequality in Europe across all of 250 or so nuts one regions of Europe, that the financial sector, very wealthy, shows a significant decline in its contribution in the period immediately following the crisis. Not surprisingly, when a credit boom deflates, the financial sector's income is reduced, and that is what drives the inequality measures. You can see the same thing when you do this geographically, and you can see it, in fact, in a falling income share in the city of London itself, a major, let's say, peak unit of income in the European Union, and an entity whose income actually affects noticeably the level of inequality in the Union as a whole. Why are these two things associated? I think the simple reason is that income distribution and the flux of financial boom and bust are actually just two aspects of the same thing. That's the lesson that one draws. Income distribution tends to be driven by fluctuating incomes at the very high end of the scale and who earns those incomes, but the financial sector and those unstable sectors, technology in particular, that the financial sector has a habit of investing in and then turning away from. Let me make a few observations about the United States and Europe, and then I want to turn specifically to what I could say about the experience of Greece. If you look at the United States and Europe from this comparative perspective and through time, what we observe is that across the states and regions of the United States, convergence of incomes was actually the norm over seven decades, from the 1930s into the end of the century. And it's across states and regions. And this was fostered by the national development strategy that began with the New Deal, complemented by political log rolling, a common military budget, and the rise of Southern political power, and the migration of the old, financed by a national continental social security system, from the North toward the sunshine of the South. This does not mean that inequalities in the country as a whole diminished necessarily, but it means that the regional aspect of those inequalities did diminish. Inequalities in the United States are notably at close geographic range. They're between Manhattan and the Bronx. Right? Not between so much between New York and Texas, whereas 60 years ago it was the difference between, let's say, Massachusetts and Alabama that defined the American inequality. This is no longer the case. Europe has evolved in quite the opposite pattern, that is to say, with a high degree of equality, relatively speaking, at close range within each nation state, particularly developed in the social democratic period following the war, but a very, very large degree of inequality across national boundaries, and particularly now with the accession of the eastern countries between the north and the southeast, between, let's say, Denmark and Romania or Bulgaria, or Norway and Portugal, you see the very large income differentials which were characteristic of the United States a long time ago. So while the EU and the Euro did foster a degree of convergence across regions at first, and this was occurred by equalization of interest rates and a flow of direct investment and debt into the, particularly to the southern countries of the Eurozone, notably but not exclusively Greece, this was a phenomenon that did not prove sustainable. It was not accompanied by the depth and range of fiscal transfers, apart from the structural funds. For example, military budgets were never integrated. It was not accompanied by the transfers to households through a common pension system that characterized the United States. And of course, it also lacked the requisite degree of regulation and accountability for loan quality, so that the flows of funds would not be tied to the whims of the credit market. This left Greece to be exposed to the global debacle, and I'll show you just a quick study to that effect that appeared in the press just a few days ago, Reuters report on the regional differentials growing larger in the wake of the financial crisis, asset values being maintained much more effectively in Germany than they are in Greece or other countries of the crisis region. Was there a Greek crisis? Was there a Greek crisis? Of course there was. Greece has never been, is not now, it has not been since the Ottomans, and it wasn't before, a well-governed state. Its officers, in the period before the global crisis in 2008-2009, freely played the role that were played by the subprime mortgagees of the United States, taking on loans that both they and the bankers who peddled them knew or should have known would not be viable if economic conditions changed. Loans for construction projects. The primary beneficiaries were, of course, construction firms, in many cases, North European. Loans for the Olympic Games, loans for military procurement, that is to say, German submarines, French aircraft, and other bits of equipment, more tanks than you can shake a stick at. But that was not all. And to lay this solely at the doorstep of the Greek state is to mistake the situation fundamentally. Because the Greek financial situation was embedded in this architecture, as I've described it, of an unsustainable European integration, leaving most of the elements of social democracy stranded at the national level and unable to sustain themselves across international boundaries in a financial and economic panic. And so the interregional convergence, which was characterized in the United States and which over 70 years, and that had been made also the larger West European countries viable in the 20th centuries, was placed on, as I've said, a fragile and unsustainable footing, and went sharply into reverse after the crisis hit. And then there was the crisis itself. It wasn't simply a European problem. The crisis was embedded in a larger neoliberal global financial order, which was intrinsically unsustainable ever since it took hold in 1980, as plainly demonstrated by the experience of the developing countries. But since 2000, driven to particular extremes of violence, as in Afghanistan and Iraq, corruption, as in the rise of the mortgage-backed securitization racket in the United States, collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps, and all of that magnificent structure of financial innovation, which essentially enabled what were undeniably criminal enterprises to infest the entire global financial system, transforming unpayable mortgages into AAA securities and peddling them to investors all around the world, but especially in Europe, under a regime of deregulation and desupervision that essentially turned the asylum over to the lunatics, making a global economic and financial collapse essentially inevitable, something which, of course, is no surprise to you here in Iceland. What made Greece special were two things. The first was, in a sense, a worldwide conspiracy, that's a word for it, which came to fruition in May of 2010 to pass the bailout of the highly leveraged North European banks, Deutsche Bank leveraged to 70-1, through the government in Athens, in order to make it appear to be a rescue of the Greeks, rather than a rescue of the German and also and especially of the French banks, many of whom owned two of the four largest Greek banks. Complicit in this conspiracy were major officials of the world order, including the president of the European Central Bank at the time, Jean-Claude Trichet, for whom ingratiation with bankers was, I think, second nature, and who proceeded to buy Greek bonds through something called the Securities Market Program in order to support their price, buying them from favored and unidentified sellers on a preferential basis in order, as I say, to support the asset prices that would otherwise have collapsed in value, and then turning around and insisting that those bonds be serviced at full value by the Greeks. Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, who wanted to avoid a credit event affecting American banks and their derivative exposures, and who therefore sanctioned and pressured the International Monetary Fund to join in this infamous set of institutions known as the Troika, European Central Bank, European Commission, and IMF. And the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, who had his own reasons, including the fact that he wanted to ingratiate himself with French banks because, as a socialist, that would enable him more easily to become the president of France. That was Dominique Strauss-Kahn, a man, as you may recall, of impeccable ethical standards. And finally, the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Angela Merkel, as well as her finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, Nicolas Sarkozy, as well as his finance minister, Christine Lagarde, who wanted to deflect apparent responsibility from the bankers to the Greeks, and thereby fostered a political narrative which bordered on a kind of national racism, assessing the situation as being the responsibility of the Greek people as a whole, failing to work hard enough and all of that stuff that one hears, while passing the bad debts from the bankers through the Greeks to the taxpayers of the European Union, including taxpayers of countries like Slovenia and Slovakia, which are not as wealthy as Greece, and which nevertheless ended up in the position of holding the bad debts that they knew or should have known would never be paid. So that was one thing that made Greece distinctive. And there truly was a conflation of the interests of the powerful to misrepresent the situation to the benefit of the banks and the detriment of the Greek people. And then there was a second thing. The second thing that was really quite interesting and that I think bears a word, and that was that uniquely in Greece, although I have to say also in Iceland, but under very different circumstances, was the emergence of a fierce internal opposition animated by a clear-headed and progressive analysis of developments accessible both in Greece and outside, thanks to the linguistic gifts and the writing of essentially one person, a professor at the University of Athens beginning around 2010, became my friend in 2011 and came to the University of Texas in 2013 as a visiting scholar, and that is, let's see, there we are, oops, there's a page up. Here we are on May 25th, 2014 in Athens at the moment of the European parliamentary elections. Yanis Varoufakis, Alexis Tsipras holding the remote control, a sign of his rise to power, no doubt, and yours truly in the middle. It was thanks, I think, very largely to really millions of words written by Yanis Varoufakis in this period from 2010 through the end of 2014, that the Greek people understood better, I think, than most populations in the south of Europe, what exactly had happened to them, what their own responsibility was, what the responsibility of their government was, but also what had been done by the powers that be in Europe. They understood that the policies which had been imposed had never been proven to work, they were not really intended to work, but were merely the standard formulas of debtor contrition and creditor domination, compounded in the Greek case by the pseudo gold standard or the straitjacket of the euro. And so it was possible in Greece for a political response to develop that was quite different from what it was in France, where it was the National Front, or other countries, Germany itself, Alternative for Deutschland, but one which had a pro-European and progressive character while nevertheless emerging from a party of the radical left. And of course, this is what happened. That's February 9th, 2015. The Minister of Finance in his office on the day after the parliament convened for the first time in the government of Alexis Tsipras. I arrived there the night before, and Yanis said to me, "Welcome to the poison chalice." Our job, actually, we were in Athens for 2 days, and then we flew to Brussels to begin the negotiations. And those negotiations were a battle, essentially, not over debt, not over European reform, much as we would have liked it, but simply over the terms of the impractical, infeasible, unsuccessful, and long-failed policies that had been imposed on Greece since May of 2010. The government did not seek new loans. It did not seek support for an expansionist policy, much as I'm a Keynesian, it was not a Keynesian strategy. It was simply focused on specific provisions of the previous program that were clearly dysfunctional and that needed to be removed before any progress could be made. These were an unrealistic target of 4.5% for a primary surplus, essentially indefinitely, a target which has almost never been met by any country and certainly could not be met by Greece. Secondly, the unethical experiment of wholesale labor market deregulation, internal devaluation, the elimination of the minimum wage and the dismantling of what was already a fairly small trade union sector in Greece in order to effect what was called internal devaluation, substitute for currency devaluation, a very painful process that destroys incomes but leaves debts intact. Pension cuts, including for those, and there are hundreds of thousands of them in Greece, living on approximately 11 or 12 euros a day. And privatizations conducted on a mass and fire sale basis, something which even the most backward neoclassical professor of economics will have to concede. If you put everything on the auction block at once, you're unlikely to get a very good price. And the government sought to stretch things out, maintain a certain equity position so that if there was an upside, it could participate in it, and to do it in an orderly way in order to be able to gain some fiscal advantage from these sales. Negotiations were pursued at three different levels, if you can call them negotiations. And at none of these levels were the merits of the Greek case ever seriously disputed. At the level of the Troika, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the Commission, we were dealing with, the finance ministry was dealing with bureaucrats who were never empowered to negotiate. discussions, but from their point of view, the discussions were a review of the existing program, and their strategy was to ask for a concession, pocket it, and ask for a new one. They never said, okay, we will come back and match your concession with one of our own. The finance ministers, the so-called Eurogroup, an ad hoc body of extremely irregular procedure, were largely driven by their internal national politics. That is to say, the East Europeans ideologically committed to austerity, and the fantasy of expansionary austerity would not admit that it would not work anywhere else or would not work in Greece. The Iberians, the Portuguese, and the Spanish, as well as the Irish, with rising left movements threatening their governments, would not make concessions because that would encourage Podemos, the Bloc Izquierda, and Sinn Féin. And the Italians and the French, a little bit more sympathetic, but unwilling to risk any political capital with the Germans in order to help out the Greeks. None of this was informed by any interest in or knowledge of what the actual situation in Greece was or what might be required to make it better. And so the Greek government was driven to try to work at the level of heads of government, including in part through the United States, and to appeal directly to Chancellor Merkel and her sense of leadership in Europe. At that level, the issue frankly came down to a question of whether any government of the left could be allowed to survive when the option was to attempt to destroy it. I would have to say that up to a point, the United States government did sympathize with the Greek government, and the president did make a number of phone calls to the chancellor asking for a compromise, reasonable compromise. But the nature of that compromise was never specified by the United States, and it's also fair to say that the United States government was driven by a larger interest in Ukraine, and that bore more heavily on its relations with Germany than Greece. And so at the end of the day, the chancellor went with the force that was the prevailing one upon her, and that was the force of her very candid and very powerful, very honest, but very dangerous finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble. We knew this was coming. We were certainly considered it far more likely than not that we would come to the 30th of June with the government out of money and no options, and we prepared, and I was responsible in part for preparing, a plan for the case where intractable situation developed that could not be overcome. I had the help here actually of several experts who had worked on Iceland, and we had at least some sense of the extent of the challenge that would be in front of us if Greece were forced to exit the euro on an emergency basis. At the end of the day, in spite of the fact that the Greek people behaved, I think, with great political maturity and determination, they were braver than their government was. Their government made the judgment that it could not run the risk of the kind of breach that would be implied by the kinds of things that we were asked to prepare for, and instead of that, it effectively capitulated in the middle of July following the referendum vote and came under regime imposed in what's called the third program. The essence of that regime is really the absence even of a pretense of reform, a pretense of movement toward Greek economic recovery. It is instead a regime that is essentially a regime of debt collection and a regime of foreclosure and liquidation. And there is just a story in the press just now that will give you a sense of what is going on. At the level of state assets, including the beaches, by the way, and some 500 islands, 500 islands, Greek public assets are being put up for sale, and they would put up for sale at very low prices to anybody who cares to take them off the hands of the Greek state. Greek beaches, uniquely in the Mediterranean, in the European Mediterranean, are public access, have been for decades. This will now, under the current regime, come to an end. Greek businesses, which is it's a country, as you undoubtedly know, of small hotels and small restaurants and small shops of various kinds, single-owned pharmacies and all of that, are caught between a value-added tax that now has a basic rate of 24%, pensions which continue to be cut, incomes that continue to fall, wages that continue to fall. As a result, the incomes of the Greek businesses do not sustain their debt payments and their tax burdens, and the Greek businesses are being forced into liquidation and bankruptcy at an accelerated rate. And finally, households who are caught between falling incomes and their mortgage payments, and those are being forced into foreclosure on a mass scale. It is what can fairly be described as a land grab and an assertion that there is in Europe today no special status associated with being a national in your own country. Essentially the same status that applies to, let's say, Puerto Rico or the other American dependencies in the Caribbean is being, the same standard is being applied to what most Europeans, I believe, felt was a confederation of nations rather than a community which was entirely to be run to the benefit of its creditor class. Why is this being done? Why was Greece uniquely excluded from the quantitative easing that has stabilized the interest rates and credit market access of the other crisis countries? Why was Greece not extended the leeway to have a little bit of fiscal expansion, such as is happening in Spain under a conservative government? I think the answer to all of that is entirely clear, and the answer is this is the politics of the day. And the politics of the day was intended to render an object lesson to the other populations of Europe. The curious fact is, while that lesson has been very, very clearly spelled out, the objects of the lesson have not proven entirely receptive to it. And you can see that the Portuguese had an election and their government of last year is gone. They now have a socialist-led coalition, not a very brave one, but nevertheless a change. The Spanish had a hung parliament and a second election now with a united left front, United Podemos. We'll see what happens. No guarantees, the election coming up on the 26th of June. The French and the Belgians are on strike and resisting in a tone that may not have been seen, and some people compare it to May of 1968, to the imposition of the so-called labor market reforms that are being proposed, especially in France. And as everybody knows, the British are voting on the 23rd of June, in their case, perhaps to leave the European Union altogether. So I would suggest that the failure to attend to inequality at the national, the regional, the continental scale, the failure to provide stabilizing mechanisms and to assure that in a national and international union, all elements are brought along in a way that's reasonably satisfactory, the consequences of that can be quite severe and will be played out in extremely unpleasant ways if ideas and policies and institutions do not change. This is the price of a Carthaginian policy in Greece. And it may prove to be very high. I'm just going to close by taking two brief passages that are I use in the introduction to my book. It's just out actually in the United States in 3 or 4 days. And they're not mine. They're what John Maynard Keynes wrote in 1919. Europe, he wrote, is solid with herself, France, Germany, Italy, Austria, and Holland, Russia, and Romania, and Poland throb together, and their structure and civilization are essentially one. And he wrote of Germany, actually, The policy of degrading the lives of millions of human beings and of depriving a whole nation of happiness should be abhorrent and detestable. Abhorrent and detestable, even if it were possible, even if it enriched ourselves, even if it did not sow decay of the whole civilized life of Europe. I'm only an observer. That is my view of what has been going on. Thank you very much.